Welcome to Computing Lives, a podcast from the IEEE Annals of the History of Computing. The Annals publishes stories. Stories of technological innovation, stories of commerce, stories of computing institutions, and stories of computing people. This institution is a memoir about a pioneering internet computing organization, BBN, which was written by one of its founders, Leo Baranek. Baranek claims that technical organizations thrive only when each new employee improves the overall quality of the company. He has titled his memoir, Founding a Culture of Engineering Creativity. During World War II, I served as director of the Harvard University's Electroacoustic Laboratory, which collaborated with the nearby Psychoacoustic Laboratory. The daily close cooperation between a group of physicists and a group of psychologists was, arguably, unique in history. One outstanding young scientist at the Physioacoustic Laboratory made a particular impression on me, J.C.R. Licklider, who demonstrated an unusual proficiency in both physics and psychology. Another individual, a psychologist, who demonstrated himself was Carl D. Kreiter. I made a point of keeping their talents close by me in the ensuing decades, as they would ultimately prove vital to the growth of Bolt, Baranek, and Newman Incorporated in the upcoming man-machine symbiosis age. In 1945, at the close of World War II, Richard Henry Bolt became an associate professor of acoustics in the physics department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. With Bolt as its director, a new acoustics laboratory was immediately formed, which had faculty supervisors from the fields of physics, electrical engineering, architecture, and mechanical and aeronautical engineering. Two professors at MIT were then world leaders in acoustics, Philip Morse and Richard D. Fay. They, along with Bolt and MIT President Carl Compton, enticed me away from Harvard in 1947 with the title of Associate Professor in Communication Engineering and Technical Director of the Acoustics Laboratory. The laboratory was financed primarily by funds from the U.S. Navy's Bureau of Ships, although there soon was additional financing from the Office of Naval Research. I began teaching a course in September 1947 called, appropriately, Acoustics. My office was across the corridor from Bolt's, and our contracts with the Institute allowed each of us one workday a week, plus weekends and summer, to do personal consulting. Requests regularly came into the office of MIT's president asking for acoustical help. Those requests were routinely routed to Bolt. One arrived in 1946 from the New York architectural firm Harrison and Abramovitz, requesting a quotation for services as potential consultant to the United Nations permanent headquarters to be built in New York City. Dick bid and won the commission. In October 1948, a set of drawings for the project arrived, which, when unrolled on his office floor, was 8 inches thick and 10 feet long. Dick realized that the project was more than a one-man job, and he called me in to share his awe. Dick immediately proposed that we form a partnership. We had papers drawn up some days later, and Bolt and Baranek came into existence. Bolt had received his Ph.D. in acoustics from the University of California at Berkeley in June 1939. He was a dynamic man with a ready smile and a brilliant mind. He had the ability to quickly absorb new fields and become adept at understanding and working in them. At MIT, he was a popular lecturer and attracted many promising students in the field of acoustics. He was a judicious, thoughtful administrator and was liked by all who came into contact with him. His relation to me was always excellent, with hardly ever any misunderstanding. The new firm, Bolt and Baranek, had the blessing of MIT's new president, James Killian. He offered to help us get started and rented us 2 rooms in the MIT Acoustics Laboratory for our use, but warned us that we would have to seek space outside of MIT if our needs expanded. Our first employees, each part-time, were 3 brilliant MIT students working for their graduate degrees, Robert Newman, Jordan Baruch, and Samuel Labate. Other consulting requests came to MIT, and soon we had to buy acoustical measuring equipment, which took up all the space in our two little rooms. A little over a year later, Bob Newman completed his architectural degree. In relatively short order, we employed him and, in 1950, changed the partnership's name to Bolt, Baranac, and Newman, the name now known as BBN. Newman had received his master's degree in physics at the University of Texas and, during World War II, had worked for 2 years at Harvard's Electroacoustic Laboratory and for the remaining part of the war at a naval research laboratory in Pennsylvania. At the end of the war, he enrolled in a graduate school program in architecture at MIT. Bob had a good eye for architectural design. He quickly learned the basics of architectural acoustics from Bolt and soon was in charge of BBN's Architectural Acoustics Division. As a lecturer to architects on acoustics, he was a master. Every architect who attended his lectures at MIT, as well as at Harvard and a dozen other top universities, vividly remember both him and what he taught. The United Nations projects was demanding. The architect, Wallace Harrison, produced a design for the General Assembly building that was a large truncated cone. The UN delegates sat at tables on the floor of the cone facing the cone's north wall. A large two-level seating space for an audience was attached to the cone, projecting externally on the south side. Bolt and Newman took responsibility for the acoustical treatment and encountered no unusual problems. The sound system design was left to me. It proved to be almost unsolvable. The architect insisted that the loudspeakers be embedded in the cone's north wall, about 15 feet behind the main podium, a sure situation for howling feedback. By carefully choosing loudspeakers and microphones with good phase characteristics, limiting the frequency range to 300 to 6,000 hertz and eliminating any acoustical resonance in the space around the embedded loudspeakers, I completed a system that worked without any feedback, and the speakers' voices were perfectly intelligible. A prestigious success at the UN headquarters building made our name known to architects everywhere, and our business boomed. In 1949, I convinced MIT's Department of Electrical Engineering to appoint Licklider as a tenured associate professor and to work with me in the acoustics laboratory on voice communications problems. A new office was built for him on the floor above mine. Shortly after his arrival, he being the only psychologist on the MIT faculty, the department chair asked Licklider to serve on a committee that established the Lincoln Laboratory, an MIT research powerhouse that was supported by the Department of Defense. The opportunity introduced Licklider to the nascent world of digital computing, although he had no occasion to work with or to learn programming on their two new experimental machines, machines called the TX-0 and the TX-2. Licklider devoted a fair amount of his time to Lincoln Lab projects, one example being his help in the lab's discovering that airplane identification by radar signals could be improved by measuring the reflected signals' modulation by the audio frequency of the rotating propellers. In addition, working in the Department of Economics and Social Sciences at the School of Humanities, Licklider hired a number of promising young psychologists, the first of which was George Miller in 1951, in an effort to form a psychology department at MIT. BBN's business grew steadily, and more staff were rapidly added. In October 49, we vacated the MIT space and moved to the second floor of a now non-existent building at 57 Brattle Street. 2 years later, in 1951, we moved into two apartments and the basement of a six-apartment building at 16 Elliott Street in Cambridge. We also opened an office in Los Angeles. In the next few years, we took over additional apartments, and by 1955, we occupied the entire building. In 56, we boasted 50 full-time employees plus several part-time employees or consultants. We moved into an existing building at 50 Moulton Street in Cambridge in 1957 and added a two-story building adjacent to it in 1959. In December 1953, BBN Incorporated, the primary reason being to isolate the partners from liabilities that came from an important area of business, the control of jet aircraft noise. Just as we had begun operations, we were contacted by the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics and by companies engaged in the manufacture of jet engines. These organizations had asked us to do design structures for testing engines that would minimize noise. With BBN's incorporation, Bolt was named chairman of the board. I was president and CEO. Labate was executive vice president. Newman was vice president. And Baruch, the treasurer. Samuel Labate had come to MIT after World War II to study in the mathematics department. He took my acoustics course and became acquainted with Dick, me, and the staff at the acoustics laboratory. Sam's master's thesis was on measurement of acoustic materials using an impedance tube. He proved to be a clear thinker and was well-liked by his fellow students and by his supervisors. Because of Sam's can-do attitude, he was a valuable and adaptable acoustical consultant who could be depended upon to carry a job through to completion. Jordan Baruch was the most brilliant of my students. He had come to MIT to be an electrical engineer and was a straight-A student. He had taken my acoustics course in 1948, the second year that I taught it. Jordan was one of 160 in the class. He was quick to understand what I was teaching and asked so many questions that after a week or so, I suggested that he yield more time to others. Jordan's doctoral committee included representatives from the Department of Electrical Engineering, Physics, and Mechanical Engineering. Jordan had what I would call a photographic memory. For example, at BBN, he read a 5-volume set of military procurement books in just a few days, and yet ably referred to almost any part of the text when discussing the context with government contracting personnel. In addition, he was, and is, well-informed about a wide variety of subjects, such as health, gardens, automobiles, and computers. The five partners owned all the stock in equal amounts and constituted the entire board. This created a concern on our part that the high-level people we were employing would become restless if all the financial profits from their work accrued only to five people. Thus, we devised several somewhat novel means to alleviate this worry and reward employees. First, we instituted the K-factor plan to inflate salaries of key personnel. The K-factor was formulated by determining the ratio, R, of the company's total gross income to its total salaries, and inserting it in a formula for K equals 0.066 plus 0.33R. The basic salary of each participant was multiplied by that K-factor. The value of K was limited to the range of 0.75 to 1.5. For many years, the K-factor varied only from 1.1 to about 1.2. The second means of reward was to establish a stock purchase plan. The purchase price was set at the beginning of the year by book value of the company, and the participant had to pay for the stock within the next 12 months. This led to a handsome gain when the company went public in 1961. The third means was to establish a promotion structure for technical personnel that paralleled the conventional corporate ladder. For example, a typical corporate progression was unit head, division head, vice president, president, and CEO. In our parallel technical ladder, the first step was the title consultant, engineer, or scientist, CE or S. The next step was for senior consultant, engineer, or scientist. The third was principal consultant, engineer, or scientist. In 1969, we finally established the title of chief consultant, engineer, or scientist. Salaries at the various levels were commensurate with the salaries of the administrative heads. Above all, I insisted that the motto of the company be, "Each new person hired should raise the average level of competence of the firm." This became an operating creed that kept us from hiring anyone whom we believed was not as smart as ourselves. The company grew without the help of outside financing, except for maintaining a line of credit at First National Bank of Boston. By 1961, with borrowings of $325,000, it was apparent that the company needed cash for expansion, and it went public, raising nearly $1 million. Baruch as treasurer and I as CEO planned the offering, working with our auditors and lawyers. An interesting point was our selection of the underwriter for the offering. We interviewed several investment firms. Payne Weber thought our offering price should be $4.50 a share. Smith Barney thought $8.50. But we chose Hemphill Noyce & Company, which took us public at $12 per share. The price on opening day rose to $18. It remained above the level of $12 well beyond the following year. As president, more and more of my time was taken up by BBN activities. Consequently, I reduced my teaching load at MIT to 75% in 1951, and then in 1953 to 50%. I resigned my professorship in 1958, thereafter teaching a two-week summer course on noise control for several years. Bolt remained a full-time professor, devoting only his one day a week to BBN. The company's extensive work in developing acoustical criteria for acceptable noise level outdoors and in building spaces resulted in a decision to develop a stronger and broader activity in psychoacoustics, the science of sound as it affects humans. From our initial interest in how people respond to aircraft noise, we were led to other aspects of psychoacoustics, notably human speech and hearing. Our company obtained government contracts to support research on speech compression, criteria for predicting speech intelligibility in noise, and finally, but certainly not least, the reaction of communities around airports to propeller aircraft noise. Around 1955, I began seriously to consider the long-range directions of the company. My thoughts were guided by my experience in World War II with the psychoacoustic personnel at the electroacoustic and psychoacoustic laboratories at Harvard, and later, in the war, by my experience as head of the Systems Research Laboratory in Jamestown, Rhode Island. The mission of that facility was to speed up the handling of information on U.S. warships so that they could more effectively combat the mounting danger of Japanese kamikaze aircraft. I visualized a potential growth region for BBN in man-machine systems, systems that efficiently amplify human labor. Two examples were in my mind: optimization of aircraft blind landing and the performance of racing boats, for example, in the America's Cup race. I reviewed my knowledge of people working in the areas of BBN that were related to this, and Licklider loomed as the outstanding candidate. He not only was a first-rate psychologist with physics training, but at MIT he had acquired considerable knowledge about the uses of computers through his exposure to the semi-automatic ground environment air defense system, the SAGE system. And also from Lincoln's computer gurus Wellesley Clark, Jay Forrester, Ken Olson, Ben Gurley. A look at my appointment book from those days shows that I courted Licklider with numerous lunches in the spring of 1956 and one crucial meeting in Los Angeles that summer. Because joining BBN meant that Licklider would have to give up a tenured faculty position at a major institution, we persuaded him by offering a rather large stock option at about $1.50 a share and the title of vice president in charge of man, machine, and information systems. Licklider came aboard in the spring of 1957. Lick, as he insisted that we call him, was outgoing and always on the verge of a smile. He ended almost every second sentence with a slight chuckle, as though he had just made a humorous statement. He walked with a gentle step, often with a Coca-Cola in his hand, and he always found the time to listen to new ideas. Relaxed and self-deprecating, Lick merged easily with the talent already at BBN. He and I worked together especially well. I cannot remember a time when we disagreed. Lick had been on staff only a few months when he told me, this was the fall of 1957, that he wanted BBN to buy a digital computer for his group. When I pointed out that we already had a punched card computer in the financial department and several analog computers in the experimental psychology group, he replied that these did not interest him. He wanted a then-state-of-the-art digital machine produced by the Royal McBee Company, a subsidiary of Royal Typewriter. "What will it cost?" I asked. "Around $30,000," he replied, rather blandly, and noted that this price tag was a discount he had already negotiated. I exclaimed. BBN has never spent anything approaching that amount on a single research apparatus. What are you going to do with it? I don't know, Lick responded. But if BBN is going to be an important company in the future, it must be in computers. I hesitated at first. $30,000 for a computer with no apparent use seemed just too reckless. But I had a great deal of faith in Lick's convictions and finally agreed that BBN should risk the funds. I presented his request to Labate and Baruch, and with their approval, Lick bought BBN into the digital era. Lick sat at that computer many hours each day, literally hoarding the machine, learning how to digital program. Licklider hired Carl Kreiter in October 1957, and he, Carl, became actively involved in speech bandwidth compression and the effects of noise on sleep. Soon thereafter, Thomas Marl, interested in auditory signal detection and artificial intelligence, and Jerome Elkin, interested in the man-machine area, joined BBN in 1958. Our 1958 client brochure stated that BBN's engineering psychology department had two divisions, one for communications studies that served to identify man's capabilities in the establishment and control of information flow, whether between humans or between men and machines, and another for man-machine studies that served to establish the engineering criteria for the optimum design of man-machine systems, whether in a factory, in a vehicle, or in a computer. Within a year of the computer's arrival, which was the fall of 1958, Ken Olson, the president of the fledgling Digital Equipment Corporation, stopped by BBN, ostensibly just to see our new computer. After chatting with us and satisfying himself that Lick really understood digital computation, he asked if we would consider a joint project. He explained that DEC had just completed construction of a prototype of its first computer, the PDP-1, and that they needed a test site for a month. We agreed to be that test site at regular hourly rates. The prototype PDP-1 was a monster compared to the Royal McBee. It would fit no place in our offices except in the visitor's lobby, where we surrounded it with Japanese screens. Lick and Ed Fredkin, a youthful and eccentric genius who came to BBN because of the Royal McBee in 1958, and several other individuals, put the PDP-1 through its paces for most of the month, after which Lick provided Olson with a list of suggested improvements, especially how to make it more user-friendly. The computer won us all over, so BBN arranged for DEC to provide us, in 1960, with its first production PDP-1 on a standard lease basis. Then Lick and I took off for Washington, D.C. to seek research contracts that would make use of this machine, which carried a price tag of $150,000. Our visits to the Department of Education, the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, NASA, and the Department of Defense proved Lick's convictions correct, and we soon secured several important contracts. In 1961, Lick hired William Neff as the head of a biomedical unit, assisted by Philip Nider and Norman Strominger. Their first government contract was for research on basic brain functions and behavior, in particular, neuromechanisms of hearing. At the same time, he hired Vincent Sharkey to work on human factors. Sharkey's contract support was most highly classified. By winter 1961, our client brochure divided BBN's systems activities into five parts. First, man-computer symbiosis, which was time-sharing, light pen control by touching the monitor, and real-time control of research studies. Second, artificial intelligence. Third, man-machine systems, which included information displays, audible signals to supplement visual radar information, and pattern recognition. Fourth, psychoacoustics and psychophysics, which encompassed intelligibility, naturalness of speech and communication systems, speech compression, deafening effects of impulse noise, brain wave responses of man to sound, and noise during wakefulness and various stages of sleep. Finally, five, biomedical research. Colorimeter of digital type, and instrumentation for recording and displaying the psychological variables and visual signals needed by surgeons during open heart and brain surgery. Also, we listed engineering psychology under the direction of John Senders, who joined BBN in 1962. He became involved in experiments on the effects of distractions on performance suffered by airplane pilots and automobile drivers. Once we had the PDP-1 in 1960, Lick brought two MIT consultants on computers into BBN's life, John McCarthy and Marvin Minsky. McCarthy had conceived of time-sharing computers and had pled with the MIT computer people to implement the concept, which they were slow to do. At BBN, he found a response in Lick and, in particular, in Ed Fredkin. Fredkin insisted that time-sharing could be done on small computers, such as the PDP-1. I kept arguing with him, McCarthy recalled in 1989. I said that an interrupt system was needed. And Fredkin said, "We can do that," McCarthy continued. "Also needed is some kind of swapper." The answer, "We can do that." An interrupt enables an external event to interrupt computations that are in progress, and a swapper has to do with swapping among large computational streams. The team, largely led by Sheldon Boylan, created a modified PDP-1 computer divided into four parts, each assigned to a separate user. In the fall of 1962, BBN conducted a public demonstration of time-sharing with one operator in Washington, D.C., and two in Cambridge. To augment the PDP-1's small memory, BBN acquired the Fast Rand rotating drum made by UNIVAC, with a 45 megabyte storage capacity and an access time of about a tenth of a second. BBN installed a time-shared information system in the winter of 1962 in the Massachusetts General Hospital that allowed several nurses and doctors to create and access patient records at a number of nurses' stations, all connected to our central computer. In 1961 and in 1962, Licklider was heavily involved in the Libraries of the Future project. In the summer of 1962, Lick was lured by the director of the Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA, to go to Washington in October and head up its Information Processing Techniques office. John Swets joined BBN in 1962 to take over the library project, and Licklider wrote the final report from Washington in the form of a book, Libraries of the Future. This report was distributed to libraries widely and has been influential in pioneering the use of computers in libraries. In the early 1960s, new activities in engineering psychology were pursued. For example, BBN was awarded a NASA U.S. Air Force contract to determine the capacity of pilots to perform and adapt under flight conditions that change quickly and in complicated ways, to recommend display requirements for information essential in the Apollo manned space vehicle system, and to teach via computers. In the artificial intelligence area, BBN's ongoing work involved recognition of patterns, memory organization, and machine language. And additionally, John Swets carried out studies on the Socratic teaching method, and Baruch continued work on the Massachusetts General time-sharing system. In 1966, BBN had two software projects that vitally needed outside help: the hospital project and a computer system planned for the company-wide use of a large firm in Boston. Bolton Bobrow convinced Frank Hart that he should come aboard to head up the Information Sciences and Computer Systems Division of BBN. Ray Nickerson also joined that year, working with Jerry Elkind. Then came ARPA's request for proposals to build the ARPANET in August of 1968. Hart was selected to manage the response, and he put together the Interface Message Processor, the IMP group. The proposal was submitted in September 1968. ARPA responded with a $1 million contract, and the first IMP was completed and shipped to the University of California, Los Angeles in September of 1969. Others followed monthly. A second IMP was shipped to the Stanford Research Institute, and on the 3rd of October, the first message on the two ARPANET stations was sent. Hello. Phonetically, hello. The work on the ARPANET coincided with the return of Dick Bolt to the company. For over a decade, BBN had been deprived of his services. He had left the company and MIT in 1957, following the non-renewal of a government research contract at the MIT Acoustics Laboratory. After his departure, he was appointed by the National Institutes of Health to be the principal consultant in biophysics to work with a new study section in that field. 3 years later, he was named associate director of the National Science Foundation, also for a 3-year stint. The following year, he was a fellow of the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. Finally, on his return to MIT, he served for several years as a lecturer in the Department of Political Science. He served BBN until he retired in 1976 and resigned from the board of directors in 81. A novel management feature applicable to a research organization, but not a manufacturing company, was inaugurated by me in about 1957. It had been my observation that a lot of time can be spent by a researcher or a consultant on problems related to money. Also, it was becoming essential to have tighter controls on chargeable time, billing of clients, and better communications with the financial office. To satisfy these growing demands, I set up a financial arm parallel to the research organization. Under this scheme, each technical department had assigned to it a financial person from this new arm. This person, whom I called the facilitator, had two bosses, the head of the department and the chief financial officer. If a person in a department wanted to buy a new piece of equipment or to set up a new research facility, he would sit down with the facilitator and outline his needs. The facilitator would work out with him the specifications on the apparatus and the space needs. Then, after obtaining approvals from the management, the facilitator would attend the purchasing of the equipment and the location and modification of the desired space. If appropriate, the facilitator would solicit competitive bids. In addition, he would make sure that each employee in his department submitted a weekly timesheet, and he kept track of sick and vacation times. He also followed the progress of each work in comparison with its contract and checked against deadlines and penalties. He drafted bills to clients based on timesheets and the terms of the contract. The facilitator was required to consult with the chief financial officer and would make sure that the department was following the financial rules of the company and the government. Obviously, he was working both for the department head and the financial officer, which meant that his salary was reviewed by both. In my opinion, this arrangement allowed the technical person more freedom to tend to his activities and not be bothered by red tape. From the financial side, contract provisions and deadlines were being met and bills went out correct and on time. Also, savings arose from competitive bidding. This financial arm remained in place until BBN moved into manufacturing. My own management style needs analysis. At the start, I was senior in age and experience to all employees except for Bolt. Through my research and the research of graduate students at MIT, I was a source of new knowledge. This meant that I took leadership in a number of key projects and acted as a close partner with the consulting staff. During this period, Bolt and Newman tended to the architectural and acoustics projects that kept pouring in. Labate was responsible for the day-to-day management, and I talked with him every day. Overall, my management style was to work with the staff whenever possible and to treat the staff as equals, to make them aware that BBN was a highly professional organization. Licklider exemplified the same style. I held weekly meetings with senior members of the staff to learn what needed to be done to improve our operations. In writing, I encouraged our staff to become members in appropriate technical societies and to write papers for publications. BBN authorized attendance at technical meetings. This attitude then carried over into the computer work that followed, although I never took part in the technical side of the man-machine and psychoacoustics endeavors. By 1962, BBN had grown to such a size that all my attention was consumed by management activities. After BBN went public in 1961, John Stratton, the new treasurer, began exerting a new influence that almost had grave consequences for BBN. First, he had the idea that BBN should grow by acquisition rather than at the 26% compound annual growth that had occurred up to then and continued through my presidency, which ended in 1969. Several small companies were acquired by BBN, mostly by an exchange of stock, but all of them failed. Then Stratton had this big idea in 1968. He became acquainted with the Graphic Controls Corporation in Buffalo, New York, which made codex charts and business forms and offered computer services. Its gross income and profits before taxes were about equal in magnitude to those of BBN. He worked out a merger agreement in which BBN would be the surviving company, but with a new name and headquarters in Cambridge or Boston. The chairman and CEO would be the then president of Graphic, and the president of the new corporation would be Sam Labate. Stratton would be the executive vice president and chief financial officer. I would become the chief scientist. I particularly remember Jerry Elkind coming to me and expressing his concern about the danger of losing many of our superior personnel if this merger took place, for a variety of reasons, including my objections to the idea. The merger was terminated officially on the 26th of February, 1970. I was happy to become aware of Frank Hart's capabilities, and I learned more about his interests and activities than almost anyone else in the computer group. From the time of his arrival in December 1960 until the request for the proposal on the ARPA network in 1968, he built up the group of researchers that won the ARPA contract, developed the ARPA network, and initiated the age of the Internet. Frank was the only software expert I have ever met who could estimate the length of time it would take to complete a proposed project and fall within the expenditures that he had guesstimated at the start. My tenure as president ended in the fall of 69. I remained for 2 years as chief scientist. Labate became president and CEO. Swetz was named general manager of BBN, and Nickerson assumed his position as director of the Information Systems Division. My leaving the office of president was the result of an unexpected development. In December 1962, I had joined a group of 30 men and women who were interested in obtaining a license for the operation of Channel 5 in Boston, a large network-affiliated television station. In 1963, on the application to the Federal Communications Commission, I had agreed to be the president of Boston Broadcasters, Inc., with the expectation that the executive vice president, Nathan David, would take over the title if Boston Broadcasters were to actually get the license. Later, David was involved in some questionable case of stock dealing, and he had to resign, so I was stuck with a new career. And following extensive newspaper publicity about the station, which identified me as Boston Broadcasting's president, I was pressured by BBN's board to resign the BBN presidency immediately. It was 2 years before the favorable and final U.S. Supreme Court ruling was received. In the interim, until 1971, I served as BBN's chief scientist. After a year of hiring and construction, Boston Broadcasting went on the air in March 1972 as WCVB-TV, Channel 5, Boston, with ABC as its affiliated network. Actually, this was a good development for BBN. I could not have managed the digital network business as well as Presidents Stephen Levy and George Conrad's, and the stockholders did much better under them. In conclusion, WCVB-TV was also a great success, and the New York Times, in a lengthy 1981 article, carried the headline, "Some say this is America's best TV station." It achieved that status through the application of my long-stated premise that each new person hired should raise the average level of the competence of the entire organization. You've been listening to Computing Lives. This podcast was based on a memoir by Leo Baranek. It's drawn from issue number 2, volume 27 of the Annals of the History of Computing. You can find more about the Annals at www.computer.org. Click Open Technical Magazines and you'll find us there. The music for this podcast came from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. You can find it at music.podshow.com. If you have any comments, you can send them to podcasts@computer.org, and you can find other Computer Society podcasts at www.computer.org/podcasts. Thank you for listening. We'll catch you next time.